The first uses of heraldry date back to the mid-12th century. It was a way in which families and knights could be identified through the use of symbols and signs on banners and shields. And importantly, it made a knight recognisable on the battlefield. Well, today, heraldry is used as a tool for researching family history, to trace antiquity, and as a symbol of personal and corporate identity. But a coat of arms isn't just made up, and it isn't cheap. In the UK, to be awarded a coat of arms, you have to apply through one of the official awarding bodies. Well, Roger Whitworth is the secretary of the White Lion Society. They do the research for the College of Arms, which is the official granting authority in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. Scotland has a separate body. Roger Whitworth, just first of all, who can have a coat of arms?
Just about anyone. Anyone can apply for a coat of arms, regardless of what status you may feel that you have. The most important thing is that you prove that you are of sufficient eminence to be awarded it.
And how would I prove that I was of sufficient eminence to be awarded it?
Well, in the past, in medieval times and Middle Ages, what would happen is you would have to prove that you were of gentlemanly class or better. And so what happens now is that eminence is usually judged on a basis of educational standards. If you have a bachelor's degree or higher, or if you have professional qualifications or if you've held a commission in the army or something of that particular type. Also, anyone who has been awarded an award under the honours system, they automatically qualify as well.
And some are granted to them if they've descended from the male line, from a person whose arms were officially granted in the past, aren't they?
That is perfectly true. It is. A lot of people don't realise that actually happens to them as well. So many people, personally I research for instance, are quite surprised to find that they have a right to a particular coat of arms.
Now, I've got to ask you this, but I know you're going to object to it. What's the difference between a coat of arms and a family crest?
Okay, this is the question. The coat of arms basically is the heraldic design that sits on a shield.
And what's the problem? So that's the bit at the top.
No. Sorry, that's the crest is the bit that sits at the top.
Ah.
So often the crest and arms are separated. For instance, on cutlery and silverware, we often see just the crest. But the whole thing should sit together.
So what's the problem with buying a coat of arms online? Because you heard those adverts at the beginning of this piece.
Well,
it's a brilliant bargain.
The problem is that's fine if you're instructing someone to use your particular arms to create items for you. If you're not. And you're picking up someone's arms of a person who has the same family name, then that may well mean that you have no rights to those arms whatsoever.
And it's illegal, isn't it?
It is illegal to do that. Basically, the person who has inherited those arms are the legal owners of those arms.
So I know Donald Trump fell into this trap, didn't he? He appropriated somebody's arms.
I think Donald Trump's encounter with the authorities was that was in Scotland, where obviously he has a greater involvement. But I think it was all arranged amicably by the end, and most of these things can be arranged amicably by negotiation.
He actually changed his coat of arms, didn't he?
I think that was the adaptations that were made were sufficient to convince the Lord Lion in Scotland that they were appropriate arms and suitably to be granted to him.
Roger Whitworth, thank you. The first uses of heraldry date back to the mid-12th century. It was a way in which families and knights could be identified through the use of symbols and signs on banners and shields. And importantly, it made a knight recognisable on the battlefield. Well, today, heraldry is used as a tool for researching family history, to trace antiquity, and as a symbol of personal and corporate identity. But a coat of arms isn't just made up, and it isn't cheap. In the UK, to be awarded a coat of arms, you have to apply through one of the official awarding bodies. Well, Roger Whitworth is the secretary of the White Lion Society. They do the research for the College of Arms, which is the official granting authority in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. Scotland has a separate body. Roger Whitworth, just first of all, who can have a coat of arms?
Just about anyone. Anyone can apply for a coat of arms, regardless of what status you may feel that you have. The most important thing is that you prove that you are of sufficient eminence to be awarded it.
And how would arms. I prove that I was of sufficient eminence to be awarded it?
Well, in the past, in medieval times, Middle Ages, what would happen is you would have to prove that you were of gentlemanly class or more or better. And so what happens now is that eminence is usually judged on a basis of educational standards. If you have a bachelor's degree or higher, or if you have professional qualifications or if you've held a commission in the army or something of that particular type. Also, anyone who has been awarded an award under the honours system, they automatically qualify as well.
And some are granted to them if they've descended from the male line, from a person whose arms were officially granted in the past, aren't they?
That is perfectly true. It is. A lot of people don't realise that actually happens to them as well. So many people, who personally I research for instance, are quite surprised to find that they have a right to a particular coat of arms.
Now, I've got to ask you this, but I know you're going to object to it. What's the difference between a coat of arms and a family crest?
Okay, this is the question. The coat of arms basically is the heraldic design that sits on a shield.
And what's the problem? So that's the bit at the top.
No. Sorry, that's the crest is the bit that sits at the top.
Ah.
So often the crest and arms are separated. For instance, on cutlery and silverware, we often see just the crests. But the whole thing should sit together.
So what's the problem with buying a coat of arms online? Because you heard those adverts at the beginning of this piece.
Well,
it's a brilliant bargain.
The problem is, and that's fine if you're instructing someone to use your particular arms to create items for you. If you're not. And you're picking up someone's arms of a person who has the same family name, then that may well mean that you have no rights to those arms whatsoever.
And it's illegal, isn't it?
It is illegal to do that. Basically, the person who has inherited those arms are the legal owners of those arms.
So I know Donald Trump fell into this trap, didn't he? He appropriated somebody's arms.
I think Donald Trump's encounter with the authorities was that was in Scotland, where obviously he has a greater involvement. But I think it was all arranged amicably by the end, and most of these things can be arranged amicably by negotiation.
He actually changed his coat of arms, didn't he?
I think that was the adaptations that were made were sufficient to convince the Lord Lion in Scotland that they were appropriate arms and suitably to be granted to him.
Roger Whitworth, thank you. The first uses of heraldry date back to the mid-12th century. It was a way in which families and knights could be identified through the use of symbols and signs on banners and shields. And importantly, it made a knight recognisable on the battlefield. Well, today, heraldry is used as a tool for researching family history, to trace antiquity, and as a symbol of personal and corporate identity. But a coat of arms isn't just made up, and it isn't cheap. In the UK, to be awarded a coat of arms, you have to apply through one of the official awarding bodies. Well, Roger Whitworth is the Secretary of the White Lion Society. They do the research for the College of Arms, which is the official granting authority in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. Scotland has a separate body. Roger Whitworth, just first of all, who can have a coat of arms?
Just about anyone. Anyone can apply for a coat of arms, regardless of what status you may feel that you have. The most important thing is that you prove that you are of sufficient eminence to be awarded it.
And how would I prove that I was of sufficient eminence to be awarded it?
Well, in the past, in medieval times, Middle Ages, what would happen is you would have to prove that you were of gentlemanly class or better. And so what happens now is that eminence is usually judged on a basis of educational standards. If you have a bachelor's degree or higher, or if you have professional qualifications professional qualifications, or if you've held a commission in the army or something of that particular type. Also, anyone who has been awarded an award under the honours system, they automatically qualify as well.
And some are granted to them if they've descended from the male line, from a person whose arms were officially granted in the past, aren't they?
That is perfectly true. It is. A lot of people don't realise that that actually happens to them as well. So many people, who personally I research for instance, are quite surprised to find that they have a right to a particular coat of arms.
Now, I've got to ask you this, but I know you're going to object to it. What's the difference between a coat of arms and a family crest?
Okay, this is the question. The coat of arms basically is the heraldic design that sits on a shield.
And what's the problem? So that's the bit at the top.
No. Sorry, that's the crest is the bit that sits at the top.
Ah.
So often the crest and arms are separated. For instance, on cutlery and silverware, we often see just the crests. But the whole thing should sit together.
So what's the problem with buying a coat of arms online? Because you heard those adverts at the beginning of this piece.
Well,
it's brilliant bargain.
The problem is that's fine if you're instructing someone to use your particular arms to create items for you. If you're not. And you're picking up someone's arms of a person who has the same family name, then that may well mean that you have no rights to those arms whatsoever.
And it's illegal, isn't it?
It is illegal to do that. Basically, the person who has inherited those arms are the legal owners of those arms.
So I know Donald Trump fell into this trap, didn't he? He appropriated somebody's arms.
I think Donald Trump's encounter with the authorities was that was in Scotland, where obviously he has a greater involvement. But I think it was all arranged amicably by the end, and most of these things can be arranged amicably by negotiation.
He actually changed his coat of arms, didn't he?
I think that was the adaptations that were made were sufficient to convince the Lord Lyon in Scotland that they were appropriate arms and suitably to be granted to him.
Roger Whitworth, thank you.
Rotunda Sands grew up in rural Oklahoma. As a girl, she worked as a pecan picker. To family members later in life, she was called Mamaji, Creek for Little Mother. Last October, she died of complications from diabetes at age 73.
She was the symbol of all the sacrifice that went into ensuring that my family has tribal identity today.
Jonadev Chowdhury is Rotunda Sands' nephew.
When the decision in McGirt came out, she was the first person I thought of.
Chowdhury is ambassador for the Muscogee Creek Nation, a diplomatic position representing the tribe's sovereign interests. He sees his Mamaji as his family's last matriarch, her life wrapped up in issues the Supreme Court spoke to.
It was a life of struggle, and it's consistent with the struggle that all of our families as Muscogee Creek have faced. And to have affirmation from the federal government's highest court that despite our struggles and because of the sacrifices of people who came before us, our nation remains whole and our reservation remains whole. It was a powerful moment that resonated with me on a very deep personal level.
That struggle and sacrifice trace back to what's known as the Trail of Tears, the 19th century forced removal of the Muscogee and other Indians from their ancestral homes in the southeast to reservations in what would become Oklahoma. Today's map still carries the clues. Tallahassee and Tulsa are variations on the same Creek word for Old Town.
Our story is a story of difficulties, but rebirth and a continued chain. Because of the ravages of time and unfortunate efforts by the state government and the federal government to dismantle this notion of home in our lands, it was an elusive concept, feeling at home in your nation's lands. And that's a feeling that many Creeks know, and a lot of Native American folks know wherever their reservation or their territory is.
The McGirt decision, written by Justice Neil Gorsuch, declared the lands remain within Indian reservations. Its direct impact is on crimes committed by tribal members on the reservation, giving the tribe and the federal government jurisdiction rather than the state.
Not one inch of land, not one fistful of sand changed ownership by this ruling. Simply, it was a recognition that the Muscogee Creek Nation's boundaries had never been disestablished or destroyed. But that's not what brought tears to so many of our eyes. You know, there's a picture in my living room of my Mamaji and my mom and their siblings, my Uncle Cliff, my Aunt Halloween, and my Uncle Leon. They're there with my grandparents. And each one of them had passed away due to the direct or indirect effects of removal, whether it be poverty or lack of resources to health care. My aunt was the first one to make it out of her 50s.
The COVID pandemic is hitting Native communities especially hard. The country is again focusing on its history of past and continuing history of racism. Do those things play into your feelings, too, about the ruling and where things are now?
Yeah, absolutely. The moment that we find ourselves, I think, is beyond just pure readings of the law. The case itself was a beautifully written, well-reasoned opinion, but it exists in a larger context. And that context shows that we have to fight to keep the gains made on a social justice level.
It's a context and history that include Rotunda Sands. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown. Rotunda Sands grew up in rural Oklahoma. As a girl, she worked as a pecan picker. To family members later in life, she was called Mamaji, Creek for Little Mother. Last October, she died of complications from diabetes at age 73.
She was the symbol of all the sacrifice that went into ensuring that my family has tribal identity today.
Jonadev Chowdhury is Rotunda Sands' nephew.
When the decision in McGirt came out, she was the first person I thought of.
Chowdhury is ambassador for the Muscogee Creek Nation, a diplomatic position representing the tribe's sovereign interests. He sees his Mama G as his family's last matriarch, her life wrapped up in issues the Supreme Court spoke to.
It was a life of struggle, and it's consistent with the struggle that all of our families as Muscogee Creek have faced. And to have affirmation from the federal government's highest court that despite our struggles and because of the sacrifices of people who came before us, our nation remains whole and our reservation remains whole. It was a powerful moment that resonated with me on a very deep personal level.
That struggle and sacrifice trace back to what's known as the Trail of Tears, the 19th century forced removal of the Muscogee and other Indians from their ancestral homes in the southeast to reservations in what would become Oklahoma. Today's map still carries the clues. Tallahassee and Tulsa are variations on the same Creek word for Old Town.
Our story is a story of difficulties, but rebirth and a continued chain. Because of the ravages of time and unfortunate efforts by the state government and the federal government to dismantle this notion of home in our lands, it was an elusive concept, feeling at home in your nation's lands. And that's a feeling that many Creeks know, and a lot of Native American folks know wherever their reservation or their territory is.
The McGirt decision, written by Justice Neil Gorsuch, declared the lands remain within Indian reservations. Its direct impact is on crimes committed by tribal members on the reservation, giving the tribe and the federal government jurisdiction rather than the state.
Not one inch of land, not one fistful of sand changed ownership by this ruling. Simply, it was a recognition that the Muscogee Creek Nation's boundaries had never been disestablished or destroyed. But that's not what brought tears to so many of our eyes. You know, there's a picture in my living room of my Mama G and my mom and their siblings, my Uncle Cliff, my Aunt Halloween, and my Uncle Leon. They're there with my grandparents. And each one of them had passed away due to the direct or indirect effects of removal, whether it be poverty or lack of resources to health care. My aunt was the first one to make it out of her 50s.
The COVID pandemic is hitting Native communities especially hard. The country is again focusing on its history of past and continuing history of racism. Do those things play into your feelings, too, about the ruling and where things are now?
Yeah, absolutely. The moment that we find ourselves, I think, is beyond just pure readings of the law. The case itself was a beautifully written, well-reasoned opinion, but it exists in a larger context. And that context shows that we have to fight to keep the gains made on a social justice level.
It's a context and history that include Rachinda Sands. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown. Rachinda Sands grew up in rural Oklahoma. As a girl, she worked as a pecan picker. To family members later in life, she was called Mama G, Creek for Little Mother. Last October, she died of complications from diabetes at age 73.
She was the symbol of all the sacrifice that went into ensuring that my family has tribal identity today.
Jonadev Chowdhury is Rachinda Sands' nephew.
When the decision in McGirt came out, she was the first person I thought of.
Chowdhury is ambassador for the Muscogee Creek Nation, a diplomatic position representing the tribe's sovereign interests. He sees his Mama G as his family's last matriarch, her life wrapped up in issues the Supreme Court spoke to.
It was a life of struggle, and it's consistent with the struggle that all of our families as Muscogee Creek have faced. And to have affirmation from the federal government's highest court that despite our struggles And because of the sacrifices of people who came before us, our nation remains whole and our reservation remains whole. It was a powerful moment that resonated with me on a very deep personal level.
That struggle and sacrifice trace back to what's known as the Trail of Tears, the 19th century forced removal of the Muscogee and other Indians from their ancestral homes in the Southeast to reservations in what would become Oklahoma. Today's map still carries the clues. Tallahassee and Tulsa are variations on the same Creek word for Old Town.
Our story is a story of difficulties, but rebirth and a continued chain. Because of the ravages of time and unfortunate efforts by the state government and the federal government to dismantle this notion of home in our lands, it was an elusive concept, feeling at home in your nation's lands. And that's a feeling that many Creeks know, and a lot of Native American folks know wherever their reservation or their territory is.
The McGirt decision, written by Justice Neil Gorsuch, declared the lands remain within Indian reservations. Its direct impact is on crimes committed by tribal members on the reservation, giving the tribe and the federal government jurisdiction rather than the state.
Not one inch of land, not one fistful of sand changed ownership by this ruling. Simply, it was a recognition that the Muscogee Creek Nation's boundaries had never been disestablished or destroyed. But that's not what brought tears to so many of our eyes. You know, there's a picture in my living room of my Mama G and my mom and their siblings, my Uncle Cliff, my Aunt Halloween, and my Uncle Leon. They're there with my grandparents. And each one of them had passed away due to the direct or indirect effects of removal, whether it be poverty or lack of resources to health care. My aunt was the first one to make it out of her 50s.
The COVID pandemic is hitting Native communities especially hard. The country is again focusing on its history of past and continuing history of racism. Do those things play into your feelings, too, about the ruling and where things are now?
Yeah, absolutely. The moment that we find ourselves, I think, is beyond just pure readings of the law. The case itself was a beautifully written, well-reasoned opinion, but it exists in a larger context. And that context shows that we have to fight to keep the gains made on a social justice level.
It's a context and history that include Rachinda Sands. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
This is Scientific American's 60 Second Science. I'm Karen Hopkin. If there's one thing we know about viruses, it's that they love to spread. The novel coronavirus is happy to use us humans as its host. Other viruses? Fancy honeybees. But like us, bees fight back. In the case of one particular virus, called Israeli acute paralysis virus, a study shows that honeybees actually use a form of social distancing to prevent transmitting the infection within their own colony. Of course, not to be outdone, the virus manipulates the bees in a way that spreads the infection to the colony next door. The study's in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Honeybees live in large communities that contain tens of thousands of related individuals in close quarters. So researchers got to wondering, how can bees keep infections from spreading like wildfire? While a graduate student at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, Tim Gernot developed an automated system for continuously tracking the behavior of thousands of individual bees. And he watched what happened when he introduced infected bees into the hive. Entomologist Adam Dozel, who worked with Gernot, describes what they saw.
We found in this study that within their own colony context, when they are interacting with their nestmates, usually their sisters, infected bees experience fewer contact behaviors, fewer mouth-to-mouth feeding contacts than bees who are not infected.
The researchers also saw the same sort of social avoidance when, instead of infecting the bees with a virus, they artificially activated the bees' immune system. So the behavior isn't driven by the virus, but by the bees' own immune response, which Dolso says makes sense. If honeybees are going to protect their colony and their queen from disease, sick bees need to keep their feelers to themselves.
They have to. They live in these really large colonies where everybody's touching each other all the time. They're all closely related. I joke that honeybees have been doing social distancing for millions of years.
At the same time, bees are under no pressure to keep infections from spreading to other colonies. And that's where the virus gains the upper hand. Amy Geoffrey, who worked on the project as a graduate student, found that the guard bees from other colonies were actually less aggressive toward incoming infected bees than they were to uninfected bees. As a result,
the infected bees are accepted into the colony at about twice the rate of control bees or immunostimulated bees.
The virus, it seems, alters the chemicals that bees produce to communicate who they are and where they're from.
And so we think that one way that the virus could be gaining entry to these other colonies is by changing the bee's physiology in a way to make it more acceptable to other colonies' guard bees.
Well, that's bad news for beekeepers, who tend to keep tens or even hundreds of hives right next to one another.
It's a really ripe situation for bees to be able to move between colonies relatively easily and bring pathogens and parasites along with them.
Seems you gotta carefully mind your beeswax and keep kept colonies healthily socially distanced.
For Scientific American's 60 Second Science, I'm Karen Hopkin.
This is Scientific American's 60 Second Science. I'm Karen Hopkin. If there's one thing we know about viruses, it's that they love to spread. The novel coronavirus is happy to use us humans as its host. Other viruses? Fancy honeybees. But like us, bees fight back. In the case of one particular virus, called Israeli acute paralysis virus, a study shows that honeybees actually use a form of social distancing to prevent transmitting the infection within their own colony. Of course, not to be outdone, the virus manipulates the bees in a way that spreads the infection to the colony next door. The study's in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Honeybees live in large communities that contain tens of thousands of related individuals in close quarters. So researchers got to wondering, how can bees keep infections from spreading like wildfire? While a graduate student at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, Tim Gernot developed an automated system for continuously tracking the behavior of thousands of individual bees. And he watched what happened when he introduced infected bees into the hive. Entomologist Adam Dozel, who worked with Gernot, describes what they saw.
We found in this study that
within their own colony context, when they are interacting with their nestmates, usually their sisters, infected bees experience fewer contact behaviors, fewer mouth-to-mouth feeding contacts than bees who are not infected.
The researchers also saw the same sort of social avoidance when, instead of infecting the bees with a virus, they artificially activated the bees' immune system. So the behavior isn't driven by the virus, but by the bees' own immune response, which Dolezal says makes sense. If honeybees are going to protect their colony and their queen from disease, sick bees need to keep their feelers to themselves.
They have to. They live in these really large colonies where everybody's touching each other all the time. They're all closely related. I joke that honeybees have been doing social distancing for millions of years.
At the same time, bees are under no pressure to keep infections from spreading to other colonies. And that's where the virus gains the upper hand. Amy Geoffrey, who worked on the project as a graduate student, found that the guard bees from other colonies were actually less aggressive toward incoming infected bees than they were to uninfected bees. As a result,
the infected bees are accepted into the colony at about twice the rate of control bees or immunostimulated bees.
The virus, it seems, alters the chemicals that bees produce to communicate who they are and where they're from.
And so we think that one way that the virus could be gaining entry to these other colonies is by changing the bee's physiology in a way to make it more acceptable to other colonies' guard bees.
Well, that's bad news for beekeepers, who tend to keep tens or even hundreds of hives right next to one another.
It's a really ripe situation for bees to be able to move between colonies relatively easily and bring pathogens and parasites along with them.
Seems you gotta carefully mind your beeswax and keep kept colonies healthily socially distanced. For Scientific American's 60 Second Science, I'm Karen Hopkin. This is Scientific American's 60 Second Science. I'm Karen Hopkin. If there's one thing we know about viruses, it's that they love to spread. The novel coronavirus is happy to use us humans as its host. Other viruses? Fancy honeybees. But like us, bees fight back. In the case of one particular virus, called Israeli acute paralysis virus, a study shows that honeybees actually use a form of social distancing to prevent transmitting the infection within their own colony. Of course, not to be outdone, the virus manipulates the bees in a way that spreads the infection to the colony next door. The study's in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Honeybees live in large communities that contain tens of thousands of related individuals in close quarters. So researchers got to wondering, how can bees keep infections from spreading like wildfire? While a graduate student at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, Tim Gernot developed an automated system for continuously tracking the behavior of thousands of individual bees, and he watched what happened when he introduced infected bees into the hive. Entomologist Adam Dolezal, who worked with Gernot, describes what they saw.
We found in this study that within their own colony context, when they are interacting with their nestmates, usually their sisters, infected bees experience fewer contact behaviors, fewer mouth-to-mouth feeding contacts than bees who are not infected.
The researchers also saw the same sort of social avoidance when, instead of infecting the bees with a virus, they artificially activated the bees' immune system. So the behavior isn't driven by the virus, but by the bees' own immune response, which Dolezal says makes sense. If honeybees are going to protect their colony and their queen from disease, sick bees need to keep their feelers to themselves.
They have to. They live in these really large colonies where everybody's touching each other all the time. They're all closely related. I joke that honeybees have been doing social distancing for millions of years.
At the same time, bees are under no pressure to keep infections from spreading to other colonies. And that's where the virus gains the upper hand. Amy Geoffrey, who worked on the project as a graduate student, found that the guard bees from other colonies were actually less aggressive toward incoming infected bees than they were to uninfected bees. As a result,
the infected bees are accepted into the colony at about twice the rate of control bees or immunostimulated bees.
The virus, it seems, alters the chemicals that bees produce to communicate who they are and where they're from.
And so we think that one way that the virus could be gaining entry to these other colonies is by changing the bee's physiology in a way to make it more acceptable to other colonies' guard bees.
Well, that's bad news for beekeepers, who tend to keep tens or even hundreds of hives right next to one another.
It's a really ripe situation for bees to be able to move between colonies relatively easily and bring pathogens and parasites along with them.
Seems you gotta carefully mind your beeswax and keep kept colonies healthily socially distanced. For Scientific American's 60 Second Science, I'm Karen Hopkins.